if they're going to put on a vibe, I want them to go that way. Like, yeah, give me the, like, fully folky vulnerable vibe, or give me, like, yeah, the complete maniac vibe.
Hello and welcome to The Vinyl Exam, the podcast about vinyl records and the people who collect them. I am your host, Sam Ahmed. Longtime listeners of this show will probably recall a series that I did in previous seasons called The 45 Review. In that series, I asked guests to discuss five of their most favorite 45s. And in this episode, which features Princeton graduate student, musician, and record collector, Kevin Crowley, it's exactly the same thing, but instead of 45s, he's going to talk about his LPs. Take a listen.
Right, so Sama asked me to pick out five records that, in the event of a house fire, which, given how this place has had a lot of housing problems, like technical issues, so you know it wouldn't surprise me if it happened. But anyway, so picking out five records that I would try to grab to get out of the house, and he reminded me that this shouldn't just be whatever records I think would be most valuable or the best, but if I have an emotional connection or they mean something to me, I should share them. So that's the idea. And in no particular order, since there's not any emphasis on good or bad necessarily, I picked records that in some cases I listened to the most, in other cases that I just was kind of the most blown away by when I made the choice. Here at the Record Exchange in Princeton, which is an amazing record shop, there's not a listening station, which is good, because otherwise you would just be there forever. There'd be no reason to leave. You could just play all their $1 records and find the best ones, or the ones that you like. With other places I've been, it's been fun to just take a listen, and in some of these cases I've found things and then grabbed them after listening. And in other cases with Princeton things, I just kind of knew it would be right, or I had an inkling of what the record was. And so part of that is like the discovery thing of like, let me grab something because I think it'll be good, and then finding that it's really potent. So the first one on top of the stack here is a record by Ty Siegel, who we were talking about before we started. He's known as a San Francisco guy. I think he grew up in SoCal too, and in a part that, it's Orange. I think he grew up in Orange County, which is like, it's one of the most conservative places in the state for sure. It's very rich people, and he's just a weird guy. So it's a funny thing to think about him growing up. I got into his music in high school, but really in college, I think, and it's sort of a White Stripes thing for me of like, he's just a dude who like really wants to do it his own way, has like a really skewed style that once you appreciate, you just find it's how kind of, I wouldn't say completely unique, because he's coming out of a really deep scene of garage leaning and sort of punk leaning people, but he's got a lot of classic rock chops. Like the songwriting that he puts together is classically structured in some sense, and he's got an ear for details of style and sort of quirky things. And I'm also really impressed with guys who just cut records by themselves, you know, have the instrumental ability to communicate and put together a song that sounds completely, normal in some sense, but also I think the power is you can be very idiosyncratic when it's just you. You can do weird little things that would be hard to describe to somebody else. And so there's a record called Goodbye Bread that I bought when I saw Ty Siegel here in Philadelphia, I guess almost 2 years ago. It's kind of funny to think about, but I've had it for a while now, and the front cover is a really amazingly wrinkled face of a dog. It's sort of almost abstracted because there's no context. It's just a close-cropped shot of a dog's head. And the title track, Goodbye Bread, is the first song, and it's, I believe, sort of a goodbye to a dog that passed of his. And you know, I'm not a scholar of his lore necessarily, but my feeling on it is that this record was kind of a departure for him, because when he came up, he was intentionally trying to be kind of like gruesome and weird. You know, I have another record by him from before this came out that has him with like this horrific looking mask on and kind of like garish colors and stuff. And this whole record is a little toned down in that regard, but still rocks really hard. And I think it's some of his most indelible hooks, like the guitar parts that he lays out. He's like kind of a monster drummer. I mean, he really plays like the dude from Black Sabbath, Bill Ward. He's got like a real stompy vibe when he plays drums, and so that just sounds really cool with some of these like well put together, well constructed guitar songs. His voice is really foregrounded. He used to kind of smear it with fuzz and reverb and stuff, and he still does, I think, on his newer stuff. And in the end, I just feel like this was a record that I knew when I saw it at the venue. I went up to the merch table to buy some stuff, and when I saw it at the venue, I'd heard it some, and you know, I'd kind of tried to do a deeper dive into some of his earlier stuff that I hadn't listened to before, and this one had stuck out to me, but I hadn't been like, yeah, I'll definitely buy it if I see it. But then when I did see it, and it was an LP, I was like, yeah, I'm definitely gonna buy it now, and was just really psyched at how some of the tracks that hadn't initially stood out just made it a cohesive record. I think it's probably one of his most cohesive, in the sense that he does not jumping around between genres. I really don't think there's almost anybody else that plays on it. It's just him putting together a bunch of tracks, and there's a mood that is sort of overarching the whole thing. It's kind of wistful, I guess. It's a little more mature, kind of. He's not just in it to like kind of poke an eye at, or poke at you. So yeah, I really dig this one, and I recommend Goodbye Bread to anybody who's into that kind of music. And you know, if you're curious, I mean, it's hard to think of who you might want to call it. Sounds like, but I mean, his stuff is worth exploring in general. Just that this one in particular, I think it's a good unit of songs. So. 'Cause you plays the game, we all play. As you today, and who sings the song? The next one, again, just pulled kind of random out of the stack, is a Bobby Womack record that I got very recently when I was in San Francisco over the holidays. On Sama's recommendation, I went down to a record shop in the Lower Haight that was really awesome. I got there just before it closed and kind of had it to myself. And in fact, the owner, who's a sweet guy, was sort of keeping it open for me to listen to some gems that I pulled at random. And I bought, I believe, four or five records, a couple of which are just really, really good, weird classic rock stuff, or not classic rock, weird rock stuff that you don't see very often. And I was just so stoked to see them that I snagged them. But it's not really that kind of shop. I think he wasn't into that stuff so much. He was really asking me about what R&B and soul stuff I liked. And I found a couple of deeper sort of soul funk cuts in that shop. And this Bobby Womack record, it's called BW, his initials, goes CNW, so country and western. And it's just the front cover is just them in some canyon in California, I assume, on horseback. It's five black men. I think one of them is definitely his dad, because his dad sings on the record, I think. Or at least there's an older gentleman who I believe could be Bobby Womack's father. And he and his dad have a little duet on this track called Tarnished Rings at the end of side one that's really great. But, you know, the name says it all. It's Bobby Womack doing country songs. And that's a kind of a catnip thing for me, in the sense that, like, I appreciate country from a distance, and I've found parts of it that I like, but never gotten into it deeply. And I know that's kind of a, you know, if you really want to understand American music, it's just as much a stream for everything that came after as a lot of the blues and R&B stuff that I at least I'm a little more familiar with. But so it was exciting to hear this or see this record, and then listening to it, you know, he's an interesting guy, Bobby, because I know some of his stuff on, like, the Across 110th Street soundtrack. I did a show at the radio station at Columbia that was a funk and soul show, and that was the theme. So I'd hear Bobby Womack every Saturday that I did the show, which was, for a while, it was like every other week. I played a bit of his stuff. We had a few of his records lying around, and I really always liked it. And I knew that he's kind of had a renaissance. He's still around, and he was able to come back and play with some contemporary people, which I think is awesome. And this was just kind of like, wow, I really want to hear what this sounds like. And then it sounds, you know, the first side is sort of a sweeter side. It's more mellowed out. And then he just goes really soulful on the second one, including some really good humor, which I think is like what I've always dug about country stuff, some of the song titles. There's a song on side two called I'd Be Ahead If I Could Quit While I'm Behind, which is just, yeah, silly sort of verbal humor. But it... Side two is sort of he takes it to like a more funky, soulful place that I think really works. The side one stuff is really great for kind of if you're feeling romantic. A song called Tarnished Rings is basically about how difficult marriage is, and just but like from a grown-ass man perspective. And that's the one that he duets with his dad on. And he just has it. I forget what he says on the record, but it's something like, you know, my dad's here and I'm going to let him speak for a minute. And then his dad does a verse or half a verse or something, and then you hear Bobby Womack say, all right, I'll take it from here, Dad. And then he sings the rest. That's great. That part's great. But the one that I think stands out is the very last song on the record, I Take It On Home. From what I can gather, I looked it up, it's a Charlie Rich song, or at least he made it famous. And it's a song about going to a bar, at least the first verse is going to a bar, having a couple beers after work, having some lady sidle up to you, who probably, you know, doesn't want to know if you're married or not, and then taking that sexual energy home to your wife, the person that you really love. And it's kind of like, I did not expect that necessarily from a country song, and the original is I think pretty knowing. Bobby, the Bobby Womack version is, it's like totally enriched by the soulful vibe and some backing vocalists, and it's really, in the end, just a declaration of sexual fidelity and a realistic portrayal that you're not only going to be sexually attracted to the person that you're with, but that relationship or that part of your relationship is reserved for them. So I think it's a really great sounding song. There's a lot of good string arrangements on this throughout. That is sort of has a funky, soulful intro, and then it really just blossoms into a beautiful song. So that's a really just sort of a one that I don't even know where it ranks in his discography. You know, he's had a lot of really good records as far as I understand, and he's still making them. But that one was just a real surprise in a lot of ways, which was great.
Make a stop along the way. A couple of drinks, just a couple of drinks. And wait for the 5 o'clock rush to go by. 5 o'clock rush to go by. But look like always, there's a lady. And it's so hard when she starts to come at all. Turn it around, take it home. I'll take it home. Sometimes I have to go out of town, and I'll be gone for a couple of days. And this buddy of mine, what a buddy. First degree. Look. And always as a lady. And it ain't easy when she starts coming home. But I'm back and going up. I turn it around.
Taking a totally different direction, this is a record called Chairs Missing by Wire, the band Wire. And these guys I know something about because before I found this record in Chicago when I was visiting my girlfriend out there, I was just in a new neighborhood. We were wandering around and I found a record shop that ended up having a bunch of sort of great early punk new wave, more on the new wave side, leading into kind of the Depeche Mode and the whole 80s synth pop vibe, which I've appreciated some of, I don't know as much about, but I found this Wire record, and these guys are sort of like, they're kind of an archetype to me of really smart people making punk music, and the birth of, which I've never understood somehow, but somehow, you know, punk and post-punk, I think, you know, if you know some people in those genres, you can kind of separate them in your head. But somehow in the UK, they happened at, like, the same time. Because I think they came out of more of a sort of home recording or just go for it. Just do what sounds right to you and don't worry about what rock music is supposed to sound like or whatever. Just like a complete redrawing of the map. And some people took it to the punk side, and some people took it sort of further and trying to use guitars to make art sort of. And as far as I understand it, I think these guys were an art school group. A lot of the best bands have been, and you know, they wrote some punk classics like 1-2-XU. You know, there's a Minor Threat version of that, and that's on their first record, which is, I had their first record growing up on CD, and I listened to it all the time. It's been on my iPod for years, so I know that one really well. This one, Chairs Missing, it's their second album, and it's got a great visual design. I mean, it's like an austere stage with very high curtains and just sort of a white plinth with a vase and some flowers, and it's just kind of presented with no context. It's just, I mean, there are no chairs. The chairs are missing for sure, but it's the design's really kind of gorgeous in my mind, and very minimal. And this band is kind of very minimal, despite all that they have going on. This record is kind of the first time they made a record that was very theatrical and performative with just two guitars, bass, and drums. On this record, they add synthesizers to really amazing effect. I think this is like one of the best blendings of guitars and synths because, I mean, in my opinion, the guitar should always lead, and so this is still a really, really strong record with like really interesting guitar playing that isn't based in like shredding or, you know, any kind of technical ability that would take away from the song. It's all built around some really weird little sort of snippets of songs. It also has, they do this thing where they'll often, you know, they make a track have not too many ideas. It's like one idea, and it could either go for a short amount of time or a long amount of time. And this has a couple of their best songs that go for 4 or 5 minutes. They're most well known for having songs that are like a minute and a half. Their first record, I think, has, you know, a handful more songs than this one. And this guy has 16 or something like that. But I just think when I found this, I had already realized how much I wanted to own this record. And it was just kind of one of those synchronous things of the universe of like, I had been thinking about looking for it in the record shop here in Princeton. And I was just in Chicago and they happened to have it. And I just got super stoked. And it's a fairly good version. You know, it's like in decent shape. Yeah, the Bobby Womack record sadly is not as good shape. It's just how it goes. Still worth having. But I think what really did it for me was I liked this record a lot, but I didn't have the heart of it. And then I sort of listened to it on vinyl and found that side two is just like, I could just listen to it over and over again because I think the guitars and what they do with the synthesizers as part of the guitar sort of attack is amazing. And some of my favorite songs that I've ever heard by them that are on here, including one that I think was sort of their poppiest, that, you know, if you want that side of them, they wrote a really sort of wistful song about, it's called Outdoor Miner. It's about a kind of worm, I'm pretty sure, that they're just talking about it eating leaves and stuff and living in the dirt. And just a great, great piece of music. And so these guys, I mean, I had a real affinity for that kind of cerebral, sort of intellectual-based punk music growing up, and these guys were part of that list for me, and finding this record on vinyl just kind of gave me another insight into why I think they're so great. Again, these guys are still around. I think they played South by Southwest couple weeks ago. I mean, they're still all over the place, and they're still releasing new music. They broke up and reformed, but they're kind of an inspiration as far as that goes as well. That they still have their vibe and their way of doing music, and it's going strong. So.
No blind spots in the leopard's eyes can only help to jeopardize the lives of lambs the shepherd cries. An afterlife for a silverfish, eternal dust, less ticklish than the clean room a house guest wears. He lies on his side as he tries to hide the fact you see of which is nonsense, but lies on his side as he trying to hide. In fact, it's the earth which is nonsense, but face worker, a serpentine miner, a roof falls, an underliner of leaf structure, the egg timer.
The next record I have is Cecil Taylor live at the Cafe Montmartre. It's been released with a really cool name, which is in the name of one of the tracks called Nefertiti, the Beautiful One Has Come. So you can see this music in, I think, both those names. And this, I mean, again, this is, I guess, really Wire and this, and maybe the last one. I had a relationship with this record before I saw it, and this is one of the first records I bought at Prex. So I just have a relationship with it for that. It's sort of one of the first records I bought when I really started listening to vinyl here at Princeton. This is like a really unique instrumentation setup for jazz. Cecil Taylor is one of the most iconic pianists to ever play. I had the really, really fortunate experience of seeing him perform in New York shortly before I left undergrad, and even though, you know, he's just diminished physically, his you can hear how much his mind and heart are still in the playing. He's an absolute genius of music as far as I'm concerned, and so this catches him at a time when I hadn't really realized it, but there just wasn't a lot of music coming out from him. He had a similar experience to Ornette Coleman, I think, where put out some amazing records from the late 50s, early 60s, a couple on Blue Note, and probably just didn't have enough recognition to make it feel like it was worthwhile to keep going along that path. So he found some collaborators. Sonny Murray's here on drums, and Jimmy Lyons is here on alto saxophone. And I mean, as an alto player, I really highly rank Jimmy Lyons for sure. He had a very long and fruitful career as part of the New York free jazz scene in the 70s. He was famous for running a loft in that scene in downtown New York, when that was really the ecosystem for this music. But this is music from the early 60s, and what I hadn't realized is 62. What I hadn't realized is that between beginning of 62 and sometime in mid-60s, this is kind of all that we have of Cecil Taylor other than random recordings and bootlegs. He just was not making new music until that point, and so that makes it very special. And the energy of this music is, if you've ever been put off by hearing Cecil Taylor play, this is a good chance to hear him when he's got two people who really understand what he's about, and they're trying to bring it into the tradition in a way. There's a song on here called D-Trad, that's what. I've always sort of interpreted that as like, he's just saying like, this is a sort of, not straight ahead thing at all, but he helps you hear more how it's in the tradition. Whereas sometimes I think with his stuff, it just comes out of nowhere and you really, it's always just an intellectual thing to like help yourself understand it. But there's some startlingly beautiful playing from him. Sonny Murray, completely unique drummer. And again, Jimmy Lyons has a couple songs, especially on the first side of this, Call and Lena, that I think are just beautiful saxophone playing and worth hearing. If you want to hear, you know, what jazz was becoming, you know, at this point, free jazz is kicked off. Everybody's running with it. And, you know, sadly, we just don't have much Cecil from this era. But this Live at the Cafe Montmartre, the thing I first heard about it was that he's playing on the house piano. And apparently it was infamously bad. You can hear that it's not clear to me if he really avoided all the bad keys or sort of deployed them sparingly and usefully. But certainly I think it's like a constraint on his playing that in some ways maybe helps the sound of this record along or does something for it. I find that really fascinating that he was, you know, just like, give me this piano. This is the house piano. I'm just going to do what I do with this instrument. And you know, I haven't heard him play with a complete piano. It's like that would be interesting to know, obviously, what that would sound like. And if you're curious, it's sort of what it sounds like. The version I have is I'm 95% sure is not helping Cecil Taylor at all, because I think it's essentially a bootleg that was repressed in Europe. It's got a great cover. It's just a beautiful shot of Cecil Taylor looking to his left at the title of the art of the record, done in nice art, and it's clear vinyl, which is sort of funny. I don't know why they would really, they don't need to do this with a bootleg, but they're claiming that the clear vinyl is to make the best sound. Something about the whatever makes the records black is magnetic, and that's bad. You know, again, It sounds great to me, but it was a fresh copy, so I don't think black or clear would have mattered. But it certainly is kind of funny to look at on the turntable. I have enjoyed that part of it, that it's clear. But I do feel bad that I couldn't put money in the right hands with this. But then again, I don't know that they've repressed it. The copy I had when I was at Columbia was a single disc with just the first album out of the two that are here. I did look it up, and there is a completely repressed recording. I should amend that. I don't know. I do know that there is a version of this that's like the complete recordings of this era with a beautiful write-up, but it's like three times LP, and it's like, you know, hundreds of dollars at this point because it came out a few years ago. So if you find that and you want this music, that's the right way to get it. But I don't know if you can find it new. And so I don't know as much about that part of it, but this music is pretty astonishing, and it's a unique little current of free jazz as done by these three guys, and just a really cool sound to have just the piano, saxophone, and drums interacting, I would say. The last record that I picked out is it's this group that, as of a year ago, I don't think I could have told you anything about other than that I, you know, heard the name somewhere. It's the Incredible String Band, and it's their record, The Hangman's Beautiful Daughter. The cover is really awesome. This is a group of two singer-songwriters who sort of fused, I think it's the Glasgow or somewhere in Scotland, the Scottish folk scene. They were in a trio, and then the third guy went to do his own thing, and these guys took a trip to Africa in the Middle East and just brought back a bunch of local instruments, folk instruments, and just tried to integrate them into these songs they were writing that are, they're kind of like the most hippie songs that have ever been written. They're just talking about, you know, what if you were a bacteria, how would you experience the world? But also bound up with like folk traditions and, you know, figures in folklore. And it's a beautiful cover. It's you have to pick them out of the lineup. There's just sort of a random batch of kids and guys and girls dressed in outlandish garb in a forest somewhere in England, I guess. It's really nice to look at. And then the back is just them, the two guys in the Incredible String Band, who are sort of the songwriters, looking like you know, wandering minstrels or shamans or something. This is an album that I don't know how I was turned on to it. This is funny. I want to say it's Spotify recommended some track from it, and I was pretty blown away. I'm pretty sure that's what happened. I just don't think they were on my radar. And so then I started listening to the music that they had available, and it really just kind of fell in love with it. It's, again, I think it's just two people who you can hear where they're coming from, but they're doing something in their own way that's still completely unique, I think, in a lot of ways. Not a lot of people have tried to follow that path because why would you try to do exactly what these guys do? But they just took a hard left turn from the folk scene in a lot of ways and made something that a lot more interesting and weird. And if you haven't heard these guys play or sing, what I think initially sets them apart is that they're singing. They do harmony well, but really both of them, when they sing, they're kind of, and I'm not going to say that they're doing quarter tone stuff or like that they brought some scales back from their sojourns, but they're not intentionally trying to sing like beautiful folk song harmony. There's something else going on that's a lot more emotive and evocative. And then the instrumentation is often guitar leavened with random hand percussion, flutes, different stringed instruments that produce a different sonority. Mike Heron is one of the songwriters, I think, is pretty well known for playing sitar a lot at an early stage of that instrument being part of, you know, modern rock music, if you can call this rock. This music to me just kind of feels like out of time. Like it's something spiritual and natural that these guys felt, you know, out of the period they were living in. And a lot of it is sort of seem to be mixed up with memory and the emotions you have as a kid. It's just very open and really fascinating listen. And then, I mean, lyrically, it's like, it's trippy, but it's not coming on tough in any way. It's not the sort of psychedelia about drugs. It's like, it's really just about nature and, you know, what it means to be a person in the world in some sense. If you're just so focused on the natural world, how do you be a part of it? And there's just some really unique melodies in here. I think the two tracks I would single out as just constantly sort of playing in my head is the first track, which it, just some nonsense word like K-O-E-E-O-A-D-D-I, Kiwadi, there. It's just a song Robin Williamson, one of the guys, is just sort of poetically pulling images, fractured images from his childhood, it feels like, and sort of laying them out in a very theatrical way. I love his song Waltz of the New Moon. That's on side two. And then the most famous one from this record is a 13-minute song that's sort of, these guys have many, many sections to their songs. They kind of write 5-minute songs that are like four parts, and they just sort of are transitioning between them fluidly. Maybe they go A, B, and then you never see B again, and then C, D, C, or something like that. And A Very Cellular Song is just the longest version of that. There's like 6 or 7 parts, and it's 13 minutes long. But there's a bit in there. You know, some of the themes are really beautiful. There's some organ in there that I think isn't on any other track. But there's a bit where they do a sort of, it's not a round, but it's just a call and response that is apparently like a Bahamian hymn from the Bahamas. And he just interpolates this into this song. And it's just really, really glorious to hear. And it really meshes surprisingly well, or at least it feels right, despite the fact that it's not coming from anywhere really as part of their universe, other than, I guess, he heard it and brought it in. So, yeah, those are the 2 or 3 standouts, I'd say.
I hear the
Thanks a lot to Kevin for sharing those records with us. Stay tuned for a full-length episode featuring Kevin, where we learn about his work, his musical background, and his attitude towards playing the drums and saxophone. Once again, my name is Salma Ahmed. You can catch us online using the handle @TheVinylExam, or on our website, www.thevinylexam.com. We release new episodes every other week on a Monday. They're on iTunes and they're on SoundCloud. So make sure to subscribe. And special thanks to our Patreon supporters, Yan Wong and Brian Siebold, and to our executive producers, Austell Gray, Ben Lack, and Janine Cuevas. Thank you so much, guys. You too can become a producer for our show by visiting our crowdfunding page, www.patreon.com/thevinylexam. I'll have links on our website. Take care, and catch you next time. Mother, everything.